Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care. Hi, everybody. I was really excited to record this next episode with Dr. Eric Coleman, where he shares with the audience about a new program of the Care Transitions program and his team and its very first partner. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pop Health Podcast. This is Gavin Ward, co-host of Pop Health Podcast. And today we are in lovely El Segundo, California. And for those of you that may not know, El Segundo is actually about a mile away from LA International Airport, where our guest, who I would have to say in the world of population health and care transitions, is probably one of the most famous that our nation has seen. He probably doesn't like how I'm saying this, but very privileged to have Dr. Eric Coleman, who's the director of the Care Transitions program, with us today. Welcome, Eric.
Good afternoon, Gavin. Thanks for having me.
No problem. How was your flight in today?
Remarkably easy. I credit my airline that I often criticize.
Eric and I were talking on the drive here to El Segundo a little bit about a couple different airlines and the pros and cons and how the industry is changing. Eric has brought quite a bit of change to the care transitions world over a decade, 20 years. Eric, how long has it been?
Yeah, well over two decades.
Well over two decades. Yeah. Great. Well, Eric, why don't we go ahead and get started? Tell us maybe something about you that I think folks look at you as maybe a leader in care transitions, transitional care, kind of a guru in what we do. But what about something that people may not know about you?
Yeah, well, if we were having this conversation in my office, Gavin, you would look up on the wall and you would see prints of the national parks. These were prints that were put together during the Depression, during the Works Progress Administration, and I'm an avid national parks fan. I've been to all 59. I grew up here in California, a California kid, so my first experience were the parks right here in our state, but I've made to venture out to all 59 of the U.S. national parks.
Wow, all 59. That's quite a bit. So I think we're talking off the air a week or two ago. Do you live pretty close to one of the parks, or is that not a national park?
About an hour and a half from Rocky Mountain National Park, which is certainly in the top 10, I would say.
Okay. And when you go to the parks, is it just hiking, camping? What do you do?
Yeah, I want to make sure that it's not just a punch a card kind of thing. In other words, at some point, I want to make sure that I enjoy something that's unique about that park. In many cases, it's a hike, but in other cases, it really is some sort of unusual feature.
Okay.
Great Basin National Park, for example, for a guy who's been involved in aging for his professional life, has the oldest trees on the planet. And how could you resist not going to see that?
So the rings, I always hear you count a tree's age by its rings. Is that true from your experience?
There are always exceptions, but as a general rule, it still works.
Okay, yeah. Great. Well, neat to know that about you. When I was going into college, I did a two-week backpacking trip, and we actually got credit going up to Yosemite.
Excellent.
Yeah, we got one unit for physical education and one unit for, I think, philosophy, because we had to read a book, and we fasted for 24 hours, and we're by ourselves. It was a lot of fun.
Wow, I'm envious.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's jump into some of the work that you've been doing over the years. So as a medical doctor, when you started studying to become a medical doctor, even before that, what made you become a medical doctor, MD?
Yeah, excellent question. I have to confess that I got pretty far through college before it even occurred to me to think about going to medical school. My early experiences were in public health. This is the early days of the AIDS epidemic in California, and okay. I had an incredible opportunity with the state of California to work for the Office of AIDS, and I think I had a chance to see firsthand really the contributions that public health makes, and so I originally saw myself going in that direction of more public health. I sort of okay. say I came to medical school through a door of public health, and I think that those early experiences, which I'm sure we'll get to this in a bit, really helped shape how I think about care transitions. Had I just gone to medical school and pursued a very a very traditional route, I don't think I would have brought those perspectives, and I don't think I would have ever tried to embrace this challenge called care transition. So that was really a pivotal moment for me, to have had that opportunity to see how important the community relationships were, to have a sense of that this is not just about what hospitals do and what healthcare professionals do, but really, you know, we've had a bit of a revival in talking about social determinants of health, but that this, of course, is not new.
Right.
But I think we're coming at it with a new energy, and I think that's the very exciting part. So I going to medical school, a bit of an afterthought. When I began seeing leaders in public health doing things that I was excited about, a number of them happened to also be physicians, and that was really what turned my attention to thinking about going to medical school. And I also got very involved. I went from AIDS to aging, and I went to medical school with the sole purpose that I wanted to become a population-based geriatrician, which I got very little reinforcement for throughout my training.
I bet. I know there's not a lot of geriatricians in our country. I think it's four-figure, like a couple thousand maybe, if I recall.
And shrinking, yes.
Yeah.
At a time when we need more. So it very interesting. I got pulled aside a number of times over the course of my training saying, why are you throwing your career away?
Oh, wow.
Very blunt, yes.
Well,
and that only made me think I must be on the right track, or people wouldn't go to such great lengths to tell me that I'm crazy.
Have any of those folks come back later in life and said, hey, I was mistaken, or have you crossed paths with any of those folks?
Yes, but no one who truly sort of said, boy, I really gave you poor advice that day.
Yeah. They're all like, I'm glad I was cheering you on the whole
time.
That's
right, yeah. The story changes. The story evolves when you start getting recognition.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So how in the world did you end up with the Care Transitions program? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was finishing up my training in Seattle and was at a point in my life where I had a lot of flexibility. And so the question was, what would be a good fit?
Okay.
Naturally, I was looking at very established programs, but I was attracted to Colorado. Colorado had recently experienced some very difficult times. A very charismatic, beloved leader recently died, and there was a lot of turmoil as a result of that. But I was sort of looking for the go big or go home opportunity, and Colorado really presented that. I think in the aftermath of such a tragedy, there was a real opportunity. You sort of think about the forest regrowing after a big fire, and that I could come in. There were people who were strong in nursing home care, people strong in home care, people strong in hospital care. And so for a transition guy to not have to build all the pieces provided some opportunity and some built-in strength, as it were. But there really was, I think, a sense of pursuing a very tried and true traditional path just didn't really hold the same excitement as going out and trying to do something that was very risky, but nevertheless critically important.
So was the Care Transitions program named the Care Transitions program? Did it exist when you first went over there? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I had a chance to build this from the ground level.
Okay.
And I had a chance to recruit the people that I thought shared in this vision and were passionate about doing the right thing. I need to give appropriate recognition to the Johnny Hartford Foundation. The Johnny Hartford Foundation is the largest philanthropic organization dedicated to older adults. And they took a big risk with me. They were willing to share in a risk that I think the traditional federal funders wouldn't touch. And so they joined in, had a shared vision. And so just one example of this, before we even designed this evidence-based model, the Care Transitions intervention, the senior program officer there, Chris Langston, said, why don't you guys put together a business case for why anyone would adopt this? And we said, well, we haven't even really put it together, much less tested it, much less published it. But that turned out to be incredibly salient advice, that we essentially put together a group of business-minded healthcare people into a room. We mocked up some data, pretending like it was 2 or 3 years down the road, and
okay.
We showed it to them, and we said, here it is, and here's the data. Now poke holes in it. Tell us everything we should have done, and they did. And they gave us great advice, and that really set us in motion to the point that people were ready to adopt this model before we had the data.
That's great. So they were willing to be the proof of concept.
They're willing to be that proof of concept. That's exactly right. And because it was, in a sense, co-designed with their input, The other piece that I think, giving credit where credit's due, from day one, we made the decision that no matter where this takes us, that we really are not the true experts. The true experts are the people who are out there receiving care, not always the best care. Yeah. And we made a commitment that we would co-design from the very beginning. And we've held that for now almost 19 years, that every time we start a new endeavor, we reach out to people who have been experiencing care and we co-design with them, whether it's our care transitions intervention, our care transition measure, our goals curriculum. We've held true to that. And I would say single-handedly, that's been the secret to our success, is that we have never thought that this is about professionals trying to figure out the problems. This is about co-design with people who've been out there experiencing care, who have insights, and who have a lot of passion to bring to this.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about, you mentioned the care transitions intervention, the care transitions measure, and what we're going to talk about at the end of the podcast, your newest venture, I guess you can say.
Yeah.
The goals curriculum, which we'll have a special announcement at the end of the show today about the goals curriculum. How did those come about, or what's the difference between those programs?
Right. So there are... One of the things I think that becomes very interesting as you sort of begin to move forward, we have this sort of analogy about having to lay the tracks and drive the train at the same time. In other words, when you're sort of going into relatively unexplored areas, you quickly realize that there's not a great infrastructure to support you.
Okay.
And so here we're saying, well, what would be the right intervention, and again, this co-design piece, and it really turns out that really that the missing piece out there is supporting people in self-management, using coaching as a way to transfer skills so that when no other health professionals are around, these people are going to know what they need to do to manage their chronic health conditions. Then you kind of butt up against the fact that other than looking at hospital readmission, there's not a lot of other measures out there. And so kind of like being out in the wilderness in Yosemite, as you pointed out, you kind of have to improvise. And so we realized there's not great measures out there. We should probably create a measure.
Okay.
Did we have any unique expertise? No. Any special training? No. It became sort of a matter of necessity. And so we said, you know, there should be a care transition measure out there. And the measure really needs to, again, reflect the consumer, the care recipient's vantage point. And so we did a lot of focus groups, tried to find out what's most important. And essentially the essence of this is whether people feel prepared for self-care as they leave the hospital, as they leave the skilled nursing facility. And how could we capture that? And then how could we give that, feed that back to the healthcare professionals in a way that's meaningful? And then, of course, down the road, how could we make this a legitimate measure that's tied into value-based purchasing and so forth? So, again, it was, I think, a necessity, the mother of invention. We ran up against a bit of a barrier that we needed some other measure. No one else had created one, and so we just kind of bootstrapped this together.
So is the measure part of the care transitions intervention, or is it separate?
Yeah, the measure is modular in that sense. A lot of people who have adopted the care transitions intervention make that one of their core measures. But we also had an opportunity to go through the National Quality Forum Good Housekeeping Seal of Approval process with our three-item care transitional measure. And then the folks who implement the, or who administer the hospital patient experience measure called HCAHPS, they got a wind of our measure and thought that would be a good addition to HCAHPS.
So
we had a little bit of an arranged marriage together.
Awesome.
Which actually turned out to be relatively effortless. They're a terrific group, and we were able to pool our expertise together. And so now the three-item care transition measure is part of HCAHPS, which means it's part of value-based purchasing, which is, I think, also, in a sense, raised awareness and also helped people come and find our website, caretransitions.org, to learn more. We now have the care transition measure has been translated into 21 languages, and that's been very gratifying. Every time someone does this, we ask their permission, and then we post it on our website, caretransitions.org, for other people to look at and other people hopefully to download and use. I don't speak 21 languages, so I cannot verify that all of these were done perfectly. Right. I can certainly stand behind the English version, but we're happy to have created sort of a community, an international community of folks who care about this area and who've been willing to take the time to create translations of the measure.
Who have been, and I'm not sure if you're allowed to share, but I'll ask anyway. You mentioned some of the folks who jumped on board at the beginning and to be part of that proof of concept. Are you allowed to share who some of your initial partners were?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that in the early days, the Medicare Advantage folks understood this. We had immediate common understanding of why this was important. You know, the fee-for-service world has taken some time, as you might imagine, obviously with the move from volume to value and bundled payment and a whole other sort of series of changes. This is Care Transitions work has become much more center stage. But in the very beginning, I would go around and talk to hospital CFOs, and they would just sort of look at me cross-eyed and it's like, why are you here? I said, well, I think, you know, there's an opportunity to improve care transitions and that might reduce readmissions. And they would sort of say, just very pointedly, you do know that's 21% of our revenue. Why would we do this?
So who would initially, not naming names, but what roles would bring you into the hospital initially? Was it care transitions case management leadership, or was it financial leadership? It doesn't sound like initially the financial folks.
Yeah, the financial folks, I would say, came after the penalties were enacted, and then all of a sudden there was a different conversation that we would have together. But I think initially were the people who were director of care management and discharge planning, and I think they could see how frustrating it was to know that you're not necessarily meeting the needs of your patients, but there was, again, this big push to reduce length of stay, and if they were readmitted, so be it.
Okay, so you mentioned 21 languages. I know on the right here, you're going to Spain here in the near future for a care transitions work out there, and wife is a lucky beneficiary of some time in Spain while you're working. She'll be out and about. Tell us, among your travels, is the program pretty much translated identically, or due to culture situations, do you have to adjust your programs?
Yeah. So we do have the ability to point to successful translation of the model into other countries. We're working with the largest insurer in Australia, and now we're working with the second largest insurer in Australia. And even though we're all English speaking, there have been some interesting sort of cultural nuances around where kind of coaching fits in and encouraging people to be more assertive in some cases. We've had to soften that assertive language. We're essentially accomplishing the same thing, but we're learning how to phrase things in ways that I think are a little bit more acceptable. We've translated the model in Singapore, and I think one of the things that really struck me, having a chance to go rounding in Singapore hospitals and skilled nursing facilities, is just how hands-on the family is in both care settings. In some respects, they're actually having a chance to model the behavior they'll be doing at home right there. It's a great simulation experience. You know, in our culture, we almost, you know, a family member reaches over and hands mom a vitamin, and all of a sudden, you know, there's pandemonium breaking out, of the Joint Commission's going to come, and, you know, and we overplay this, of course. But I think what was very interesting in Singapore was how the family is already kind of attuned into what the challenges of going home, and they actually have a chance to begin practicing or rehearsing that before they go. And so we've always said with our care transitions intervention, it doesn't make sense to start this until after the person gets home, because they're not really participating in their care just yet. But in Singapore, the patient and the family have a little bit more of a head start. And so those are two examples where we've been able to translate. I think in fairness, I should point out we have other international partners, but so far we haven't partnered with a country where English is not the primary language. And so that's a challenge we're looking to take on in the future, but we don't have anything to point to as of yet.
Okay, fair enough.
So if any of your podcast listeners out there would like to introduce us to their favorite country that might be interested in adoption, I'm sure we'd like to have that conversation.
And if anybody reaches out to Gavin@pophealthpodcast.com with that information, you get a free Pop Health Podcast t-shirt.
Ooh.
And so I want to encourage y'all listening.
Yes.
If we want, we can help Dr. Coleman here. If there's a
it's
country.
It's a fine t-shirt, by the way. I'm looking at it right now.
I do wear it when I record the episode. So Eric gets to see a nice little example in front of him today. Okay. So we talked about your hospital partners. You mentioned SNFs or skilled nursing facilities earlier. At this time, are all of your partners acute care facilities, or tell us more if there's other folks out there?
Yeah,
too.
So I would say it's been an interesting kind of series of waves. So the first wave, as I mentioned, Medicare Advantage, kind of the insurer wave. Yeah. And then I think as times marched on, a large integrated delivery systems were kind of the second wave, because they could really see how this kind of pulls the different units together. And then eventually when penalties got started, the hospitals came along. But I really also want to give an important shout out to community-based organizations.
Absolutely.
In particular the area agencies on aging. And so we had a rather unique opportunity a number of years ago when President Obama took office. He tapped one of our senators, Ken Salazar, to be in the Department of Interior, and that created an opening for a Senate seat. Michael Bennett took that Senate seat, and Senator Bennett brought four or five of us together and said, I really want to do something for Medicare beneficiaries. I want you guys to go into the kitchen and whip something up and bring it back and tell me what you want to do. It would have been so easy at that point to come back and say, well, of course, we need a new billing code under Medicare for transitional care services. But all we thought that would do is just create more infighting among different organizations. And instead, we put the idea out there about what if instead of the dollars going to the hospital, what if the dollars went to the community-based organization? And again,
right.
I referenced earlier my early influences working in California during the AIDS epidemic and how important the community-based organizations really were to moving us forward. And so I think those early seeds were planted, and this opportunity, we came back and presented to the senator the idea of having the community-based organization receive the funds to implement care transition services as opposed to having it go to the traditional health cares. And so I'll say more about that as we go along, but I just want to make sure we talk about that. And I think the skilled nursing facilities, now that they're starting to face penalties, now that they're being courted to be part of bundled payment and other things, I think there's a real opportunity. We've included skilled nursing facilities since the very beginning in our earliest efforts, but we again realize that the intervention of coaching for skill transfer really only makes sense once people are home.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I believe Partners in Care Foundation out here in the LA area, their team has studied your model. And I was actually talking to a couple folks yesterday at an event by the Health Services Advisory Group out here in the Los Angeles area. And a couple of folks I'd mentioned that I was going to see today because they were talking about the podcast. And they're like, oh, yeah, we went to this conference just to meet Dr. Eric Coleman, and it was, we use the term, I do in my regular, role, my full-time role, we say CBO for community-based organization.
Sure.
And, it's nice that one of, the groups that I work with, Partners in Care, has had a chance to learn from your organization. So, we've talked a lot about the Care Transitions Program, the Care Transitions Intervention. Are you able to pinpoint, or if you had to maybe tell one day, if you have grandchildren down in the future, what would you say is what made you excited about your career, or what has been a highlight besides being able to say over 1,000 groups have benefited from the models we've created? Is there anything that stands out to you?
Yeah. So, I'm, normally not someone who sort of seeks the limelight or awards or attention or anything like that. This really, I think, emanated from the sense that my role as a clinician, as a geriatrician, running around trying to improve care transitions and realizing how powerless I was for my own patients in my own hospital, just sort of recognizing how broken it is. And so I think, you know, fast forward, I made reference to working with Senator Bennett in the community-based care transition program and working with community-based organizations. Preceding the Affordable Care Act, we actually put legislation together called the Community-Based Care Transitions Program, which allocated $500 million to create these partnerships. And eventually it was folded into the Affordable Care Act. I would say that was a sort of a pivotal moment in terms of not only having care transitions become a much more everyday term, but the fact that there was a deliberate attempt to create a true partnership between the community and the hospital around meeting the needs of vulnerable people who really need support during the time when no health professionals are around.
Yeah, no, that's really neat. And I know during today's show, we don't have a ton of time to get into the weeds of what the Care Transitions Program is or CTI. So for folks who want to get the fine details and see, hey, this makes sense, I need to learn more, what was the website again?
So it's very easy. It's just caretransitions.org.
Okay.
There really are two sides to the website. There's one for more oriented towards professionals, but there's also one oriented towards consumers and their families, with a lot of resources and a lot of linking to some of our partners who are doing great work out there, especially around family caregiving. And so do come take a look, caretransitions.org.
Very good. And at the end of the show, we'll give you that website link as well. So as we get towards the latter stages of today's show, one thing I mentioned mid-show is we kind of have an exciting announcement as part of the goals curriculum with the Care Transitions Program. And I have to say I've been privileged to learn about the goals curriculum, I don't know, over, 3 to 5 months?
Yeah.
We've been chatting. Tell us, Eric, before we make the announcement, what is the goals curriculum?
Yeah, thank you. So we have, as you'd imagine, you know, sort of our flagship program, the Care Transitions Intervention, but we're always, I think, trying to advance the field. And so we have a number of things kind of in development. And we've been working on this goals curriculum now for, I would say, a year or two. And I think we sort of recognize that for some folks, adopting the Care Transitions Intervention model itself may be more than they're interested in. But we also have an opportunity, I think, to really leverage just how powerful goal setting and goal attainment can be. We continually, I think a number of us in healthcare get frustrated about how just easily patients get brandished with this, you know, label across their forehead for being non-compliant. And we, you know, in a way, I think, denigrate them at some level. And one of the things that we really recognize is that when you take the time to probe a little bit and ask someone, you know, what's meaningful to you? What gives you joy? What's something that you used to do before, but maybe for health reasons you're not able to get back to doing? Maybe we could work on this together. Not only do you connect with people on a whole nother level, nobody sees themselves as a person, as a disease like diabetes or heart failure. They're themselves. And they want to get back to watching their granddaughter play soccer, and they want to get back to walking their dog, and they want, and when you start with those goals, first of all, you realize these people have incredible motivation.
Yeah.
And to sort of write them off as being non-compliant and they could care less. But I think what you also realize is the goals are sort of a passageway to areas of their life where they've been successful.
Yeah.
And they're able to channel that strength. And they have confidence, and they remember times when they were able to overcome some difficulties. There is something about healthcare where I hate to say this out loud, but I think we do foster some dependency in people. And the goals, I think, are a way of breaking away from that. And so the goals curriculum is designed for frontline folks, who are working with people with chronic health conditions as a way to better connect with them, establish more longitudinal relationships, certainly creating more trust. But it also really, I think, gets back to the core of who these people are and makes them feel as individuals as opposed to just one more person that's going to be seen that day. And so the goals curriculum is something that we wanted to make very user-friendly, something that people could go through in an hour. There's an opportunity for self-assessment. There's an opportunity in the end to actually print out a certificate saying that you have successfully gone through the goals curriculum. And so we've tried to make this a really good experience for the frontline clinicians, but also one that they can incorporate into their everyday interactions with their clients or patients or members or whatever names we're using for them.
Yeah, so thanks for sharing with our audience today, Eric, and I've had the privilege of learning that over the last few months. And our announcement today is for the first time, the Care Transitions Program's goals curriculum is now going to be utilized with 24-hour home care here in California, Arizona, and Texas. And we'll be rolling that out, our 24-hour home care, which is kind of my full-time gig. We'll be rolling that out in the next few months. And I know starting about the summertime, you'll be able to start taking on some other folks as well.
Sure, yeah.
As we kick it off this spring. So just really excited and appreciate the opportunity to be your first partner as a professional caregiving non-medical agency. Just really excited. And we really believe that the professional caregivers, the folks that are in the home doing some really tough work, may not have a clinical license, may not be an RN or LCSW or advanced nurse, can really make a difference.
Absolutely.
And we really think, especially if we have a culture fit, that's going to be huge.
That's right.
So I'm really looking forward to sharing some outcomes with you and looking to see the success of the goals curriculum here and nationally, as I know you roll it out nationally.
Yeah.
So
we value the opportunity to partner with your organization. Thank you, Gavin.
You're welcome, Eric. So, we are towards the end of the show today. We've talked a little bit about the Care Transitions program and the Care Transitions measure, Care Transitions intervention, the goals curriculum. Where do you see the future for your organization, Eric? Where are you guys headed?
Yeah, so I think one of the things we would like to become even better at is being more externally facing and having an opportunity to work with an even more diverse set of provider organizations, both here as well as outside the United States. And so we are taking a close look at what our current skill sets and capacity are, and we're looking to expand to be able to be find those points of leverage to reach out to maybe harder to reach populations, for example, and also learn, I think, a little bit more about what are some ways of sharing the innovations that we've developed in ways that allow people to plug and play.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I know you've touched over 1,000 organizations here in North America and the world. And I'm sure I'm not sure if you have a patient count, but I'm sure that's got to be probably millions of patients have been touched somehow at this point with your program. So appreciate the opportunity of you coming by the podcast today, Eric, and look forward to staying in touch and kind of seeing the outcomes of this new goals curriculum program. And perhaps we'll have you on the show down the road. So again, everybody, we've had Dr. Eric Coleman, Director of the Care Transitions Program, as our guest today. Eric, any final words for our audience of healthcare professionals? Again, maybe the site. How do they find your site?
Yeah, please come visit us. It's caretransitions.org. And there's a lot to find there. We'd be happy to share it with you.
Very good. Well, again, Eric, thanks so much for joining us. And everybody, if you've liked today's episode, feel free to download future episodes on iTunes or Stitcher, which we actually are now on Stitcher, and of course, pophealthpodcast.com. And we have a goal this year of getting over 100 likes. So if you like our show, feel free to like us on iTunes and stay tuned for the next episode of Pop Health Podcast. Take care, everybody.